Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
How Russia may try to influence the 2018 midterm elections. That's what U.S. intelligence agencies are warning Congress about. In fact, the Russians are already meddling in the election, even though we're 9 months out from it. How will they do it? Is there anything American security officials can do about it? We're turning to Molly McHugh. She's a specialist in U.S.-Russian relations and security, and she joins us this morning from near Washington. Molly, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Does the Justice Department and Robert Mueller's grand jury indictment of the Russian citizens tell you anything about how Russia was doing this and what they may do again that you didn't already know?
I think the document was really fascinating because this was probably the most significant window, not only into the questions we've been asking about the 2016 election, but about modern intelligence operations being run by the Russians. And that's really the only way to view what is laid out in that indictment, which is 37 pages of incredibly detailed documentation of what is basically a modern digital illegals program, to use the old Soviet term, but deep cover operatives working in American cyberspace to gather intelligence and influence opinion. And it's a really momentous document.
The story I was reading in the New York Times about some of these details that you're talking about says that the way they were working through social media, even syntax and some of the things that they were suggesting on social media, like for rallies or some kind of gatherings, struck the people who were seeing these tweets and Facebook posts as rather odd, but most people just kind of moved on. I mean, as we approach the 2018 election, what would you say about watching in those spaces for what the Russians are doing?
I think that is the powerful thing about social media, the ability to connect people, as we've all discussed for years. But for operations like this, for these sort of false personas that were meant to embed in the American electorate and different American interest groups, they try to emulate the groups that they're working within. And sometimes they get it wrong. They're not native English speakers. They do use sort of machine learning and other tools to improve their English and the way they interact with environments. But there are things that are off. The problem being, all of us are a little bit sloppy about how we tweet sometimes, and maybe our English isn't the best, or we're deleting words to make it fit within the limit. So I think sometimes we're not as aware that weird stuff we're seeing is weird because we just assume it's normal, sloppy social media discourse. But I do think people are now a little more aware of this. I think there are groups, including one that I'm working with now, that are looking at ways to engage citizens more broadly.
Excellent.
In the monitoring and reporting and recording of what they see on social media so that these things can be better documented and tracked and mapped so that people are more aware of what's coming across their environment and what it's for.
So I'm really interested in that. What are you telling average citizens through this organization you're working with to do about it?
There's a lot of debate about what to do about it. What is actually the most effective way to make people aware of what they're seeing and what it intends to do? For me, one of the biggest steps is the transparency and awareness and explanation of how these things work. A few weeks ago, I, using research from my new group, which is called New Media Frontier, did a long documentation of the Release the Memo campaign, this sort of hashtag that popped up on social media about the FISA memo that Devin Nunes was writing out of the House Intelligence Committee, and where that came from and how it moved through social media initially to become this sort of viral campaign pushing forward this narrative. And in that, we really tried to be detailed in how we showed different kinds of accounts interacting together to put this information in front of influencers to ramp up these campaigns to achieve specific outcomes with specific targeting. And I think it's really important not just to say in some of the headlines that were written about this before, Russian bots are pushing this or Republican far-right influencers are pushing this, But to show how these things actually work, how they work, and what they try to achieve, I think the more we can explain to people consuming information, how information is meant to persuade them, the more able they are to understand how these tools are being used.
This is super valuable because even when I go around and talk to people about fake news, there is this like helplessness, this despair-driven helplessness. Like there's nothing I can do about it. You know, I have no power over this. You do have power over what you're going to consume as fake news. And I hear you saying today, you do have power as an individual American voter.
Absolutely. And I think this has been the sort of critical piece that I have brought from my past experience to trying to work on these issues in the United States, having worked in the region in Georgia, Moldova, Ukraine, and the Baltic states, watching how Russia has developed and deployed these tools against other places. The reason there's sometimes a lower threshold for Americans versus people closer to this fight is they're more aware of the narrative and the goals of Russian disinformation over time. They have more of a historical connection to it. They see it a little bit more clearly. So when they hear certain narratives that seem odd and are clearly meant to, for example, create division between Russian-speaking Estonians and Estonian-speaking Estonians, they often are more likely to dismiss this and say, meh, just the Russians playing around with stupid news again. And they know which news outlets are not reliable, which ones sort of stir this pot. Here, we're a little more trusting of our information space, which is the wonderful thing about Americans, that they are optimistic and open and trusting and sometimes a little bit naive. But I say that in a good way. I mean, it's part of what makes our society great, that there is this tremendous sense of optimism for everything. But we probably need to develop a little bit more cynicism in how we are viewing and consuming information and understanding the narratives, not just the question is much harder than is this true or not. It is what is the purpose of information, and helping people understand the narrative aims of disinformation campaigns, whether they be Russian or alt-right or other, is really important because it gives you that sort of gut check against information that you see, and you can say, that seems weird. It's probably part of this. You know, let's look for something else. But we're a little behind in helping Americans do that, particularly because we do not have vocal leadership on these issues in our country right now.
You mean the president not talking about
absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. Yeah. And continuing to just sort of throw around the term fake news as if this is somehow an explanation of things. But disinformation and coercive propaganda is a lot more than fake stories or false stories. It is the way that it is used. It is the way that it is injected into different environments with persuasive narrative and manipulative tactics. And all of this is something we need to understand better. But the more I think we can inform individual consumers of information about these things, the better off we will be, since apparently our government and technology companies are not going to help close that gap.
Right. Let's put the agency back in the hands of voters, which is what we're talking about here.
Absolutely.
One of the other things that's interesting here is these troll farms or whatever they... You know what? I should ask you. Now, are these rooms full, the way we would think of telemarketing rooms where people are working on computers and... You know, they have kind of, they're given an agenda and they work together on that. How does this work? How does this work?
Yeah. And you know, there's been some really great reporting, mostly in Russian, granted, but some has been in The Washington Post and The New York Times as well. But the Russian reporting of troll escapees, essentially, people who used to work at these troll farms who are now out and sort of monitoring and or providing information on background to other journalists. The details are really fascinating, but it's exactly that. It is a giant building that they show up at with very few sort of benefits or resources or amenities. They work 12-hour shifts, 2 days at a time, 2 days on, 2 days off. And they're given, you know, accounts that they use to post comments. They're told to comment on things, to post original content, to post specific narrative. You often see the sort of cut and paste messages that are going out on Twitter or things on Facebook if you start to look for them, similar graphic images and videos and memes. But they kind of come in and get an assignment and they have to spend a certain amount of time sending a certain amount of messages in order to earn their salary. And for many of them, some of the detail in the Mueller indictment that was so interesting, These are not trained intelligence operatives, despite the fact that they are performing essentially an intelligence function. They recruited Western-educated Russians, people with native English experience, sort of experience outside of the country, who would be more aware of American culture and have those kind of experiences that would help inform the information that they were putting online. But the whole environment is set up to, it's sort of a big giant fraternity of disinformation, where they have scripted talking points that they can adapt and evolve, topics they're supposed to contribute to and pursue, fake accounts and identities that are set up for them, sometimes that have significantly deep established backgrounds behind them that are very old and have been working in the space for a long time. And the kind of interplay between these individuals is very interesting. But yeah, it's a big building full of people tweeting out a lot of crap.
You've just hit on something, though, that I want to come back to. You said that they have an understanding of our political environment. They also seem to understand religion and race. I mean, it appears that in some cases they have a fairly sophisticated understanding of how religion and race get into and are discussed in our political environment. And that was surprising.
It is surprising. I think one of the things we as Americans don't often see is what we project to the world about ourselves.
Yeah.
And a huge amount of content in terms of TV and movies and documentaries and books and other things is American originated. And when people are watching movies about police violence abroad, they learn a lot in their mind about some aspect of American society that projects. Same with our political system and how we view social divides and other issues. There's a tremendous amount of writing and research put out in very public ways that anybody who wants to consume it can do so. You know, I've worked overseas with as advisors to foreign governments in the past. And the Georgians that I used to work with, who were very savvy about American politics, many of them had spent time as exchange students in the United States just as the Soviet Union was collapsing. They were really interested in democratic systems. They knew more about American politics than I did. They could tell you which districts in Florida the Republicans needed to win if they were going to take the House back. And I would just look at them like,
wow,
how the hell do you know all of this? But the answer was they read a lot. In the case of the troll farms, they were given sort of very basic assignments. Read, you know, watch House of Cards, watch this movie. Here's some popular things you can refer to gain a sense of American culture. But you can do that relatively easily based on, in a not necessarily nuanced way, based on pop culture more than anything else.
Molly McHugh is with us if you've just tuned in. She's a specialist in security issues in U.S.-Russia relations. And we're talking to her about some of the details that we learned in the Mueller indictment of 13 Russians and three companies about how these troll farms work. But we're also talking to her about their larger agenda. And then I think importantly for this conversation, what we as average American voters can do about it. I've been wondering if these Russian trollers bear some resemblance, I guess, Molly, to, you know, to a virus. Just as a treatment or a cure gets ahead of a virus, the virus adapts and changes. Is there any similarity to the way these, I mean, they're working in digital space. That's pretty malleable. Mm-hmm. Have they figured out how to stay ahead of whatever approach we're using to try to shut them down? I guess that's my key question.
The idea is essentially, these are the tools that a less powerful opponent uses against a more powerful enemy to attack and dismay and erode the ability to fight of an enemy until they just sort of stop paying attention to it. So think of it as a small-scale resistance movement against an occupying power. It's mm-hmm. it's that type of mentality of using cheap, light, fast tactics to erode the capabilities of a powerful opponent to defend against them. And it's the same in information space. And the Russians have been very aggressive about learning how these things work, adapting them, using them against a variety of different countries. The truth of all of this is the basis of what we think of as political disinformation or geopolitical disinformation is basic digital marketing. That's where it starts. Wow. So the tactics are pretty straightforward if you know how to use data-driven targeting and profiling. The difference is the purpose of the information behind it. This is not the promotion of a political agenda, but more psychological targeting aimed at activating or suppressing different parts of a population to do things.
I guess what I'm trying to understand here is there an overall agenda somewhere from Putin that says part of the way we will deal with the West is, and you've said that Putin's goal is to sow disinformation and this chaos theory right around
mm-hmm.
democracy.
Absolutely.
See, things don't work. See, you people that believe in democracy, you can't trust what you think you know. I mean, how specific would Putin be about using these kinds of tools to achieve those goals?
I think the strength of the current system in Russia, which is primarily a security state-driven structure, is this weird informality they've developed. Many of the actors involved are not necessarily on speed dial to Putin or to one of his allies, but there's an understanding of the agenda and there's an understanding of the system and the rewards that you get if you contribute to the goals of the state. And so I think that initially this was part of the same thing, where you had younger Russian political operatives, people interested in the space, working in the region, seeing how other places were modernizing politics, modernizing campaigning, modernizing marketing, and kind of thinking in that, hey, if I can figure out how to get this right for these other purposes, that could make me a really big deal back home. And certainly you saw some of this in individuals who are not unrelated to the Trump-Russia investigations. Konstantin Kalimnik, who is a Russian who was working in Ukraine with Paul Manafort, was very much one of these entrepreneurial individuals who was constantly looking for ways to be useful to powerful men in Russia. And you see this pattern kind of over and over again as you dig through the indictments and the players relating to them, that there's an understanding of the rewards of the system if you can contribute to the goals of the state. And that is a really powerful motivator when the money is good.
So, Molly, what's your understanding about why, and if you believe this, I should ask you that, do you believe that Russia wanted Trump to win the election?
I think there was definitely a point at which they decided that was the most useful vehicle for what they were trying to achieve at the moment. I don't think it was initially a super personal choice. This guy is going to be the greatest president for us ever. Trump is very much the chaos president. Mm. And all of that chaos and churn and upheaval is extremely useful for what Russia wants, leaving aside the personality issues, leaving aside the debate that you'll see now about, well, if you ignore all the noise, the policy happening behind the scenes is achieving things that are bad for Russia, you know, helping on North Korea, whatever you might say. Some of that is true. However, the noise is so important in this particular aspect, because while we are more focused on ourselves, what is happening, should America be more present at home and less present abroad? We have destroyed our relationships with our allies in the way that we are currently interacting with them at a leadership level, which is not to say the military and others are not maintaining bilateral ties in an extremely useful way. But leadership matters. And all of those relationships are eroding and decaying. And I think this dynamic is so important to focus on. And regardless if you are a supporter of President Trump or a critic of President Trump, what Putin wants is working. Our relationship with our most powerful allies, which is the Transatlantic Alliance, is eroding and decaying. Europe is much more isolated from the United States than it ever has been since World War II. Russia is advancing its strategic aims in the world. They have new military bases in the Mediterranean, across the Middle East. They are negotiating new ones on the Red Sea. They are much more active in Asia. They are right behind the North Koreans, provoking a crisis on the Korean Peninsula. They have expanded their reach and operations in the Arctic, primarily for resource reasons, but also for military purposes. They are much more engaged in rebuilding economic and political ties in South America, in Latin America, and in Africa. Putin is very successful right now in the way that he is projecting Russian power in the world. And we are at an extreme disadvantage in many cases because of this, because we are not being very clear about what they are doing, what their objectives are, and the fact that they're achieving them relatively easily with not very much money and with capabilities that we view as inferior to our own.
You know, I was just going to say, when you went down through the list of what Putin wants and how he's doing this across the global landscape, I mean, there are plenty of Americans who believe, as President Trump appears to believe, that Europe should stand more on their own, that it's time for the United States to stop investing so much money and keeping troops all over Europe. I mean, as a policy, you could acknowledge, mm-hmm. yes, there are people that believe that, and maybe they believe that for reasons that make sense to them, right?
Absolutely. And these are narratives that have been pushed specifically by the Trump campaign for years. They are deeply embedded in part of the American mindset now.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, they I don't want to say prey upon, but leverage unrest and unhappiness that is very real. Even people who are not supporters of Trump from the middle parts of the country, there are very real feelings behind what evolved into the support of the president's agenda.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that huge parts of society and the economy and geographically and otherwise have been left behind by this new economy and the way that the American economy is developing. It's just ironic that this sentiment has manifested into this idea that the state should be supporting nothing somehow. But the sentiment is very real, and I think that is something that's very hard to ignore. And it's very easy to exploit that, to exploit the idea that your government is not doing as much for you as it should into, so why the hell are we doing all these other things overseas? What are all these wars? This stuff is so expensive. What a waste of time. But I think this really speaks to the fact that, and true of both parties, the leadership of our country has for a long time not effectively communicated to our public about our values, about the importance of these relationships, and about where American power and wealth come from. It is not because we are a natively wonderful place with lots of resources and wealth, although that is, in fact, a big benefit for us, that we have a tremendously large country with a lot of natural resources that sort of started our economic growth. But the American position in the world as this dominant economic force, this dominant military force, came out of the post-World War II structures. It was not because we had this amazing reach into the world already. We built a market in Europe. We made that the place that we were exporting things to. We made this our alliance. We made this our projection of power into the world. And we very much need this in order to maintain the type of American image and power that we see ourselves as having. Without Europe, without the transatlantic alliance, what is our region? When everybody talks about regional powers, everybody should sort of stay in their own sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that leave us? Latin America hates our guts. Okay, I guess we've got Canada. But the projection of American power in the world and the thing that makes us an economically and militarily powerful country is born from the framework of the transatlantic alliance, and that is not going to change anytime soon.
So,
and we very much need to reinforce that.
So this leads to my next question, but let me say this. Molly McHugh is with us if you've just joined in, and we're talking to her as a specialist in U.S.-Russian relations and security about this warning that U.S. intelligence agencies gave to Congress about Russians meddling already in the upcoming 2018 midterm elections. Does it matter what the president says publicly and, I don't know, the way he thinks privately with the way the bureaucracy and the longtime career people that we have in these different agencies, with the way they're working and what they're doing when it comes to Russian interference and American goals around that? I guess I'm asking you, how much does it matter that the president seems to want to criticize everybody except Putin when you get down to the brass tacks of what's really being done mm-hmm. behind the scenes?
I think you really hit on four extremely important aspects of how to evaluate this. One, what the president says publicly. Two, what he actually thinks. Three, what the government is actually doing. And four, do they have the capacity to continue to do those things in an empowered and aggressive way? And the answers to those questions are important, and some of them are very troubling. I think it does very much matter what the president says. I know his supporters will constantly come out and say, don't listen to what he says, look at what he does. That is also a very strange and disingenuous way to approach things.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, you can say that. Like, if everything that comes out of his mouth is nonsense, all right, then everything coming out of the president's mouth is nonsense. How do you project and assert American leadership in the world if the most effective vehicle for doing that has effectively established himself as a liar and completely changeable and disingenuous in most of what he says? I mean, this is just the argument that this doesn't matter is silly. It obviously matters tremendously much when he's fighting personal, strange personality fights on Twitter instead of providing leadership for the country and the world. The what the he actually thinks part, obviously also extremely troubling. Most of the reporting coming out of the White House is not of a consistent, cautious, detail-oriented person, but someone who is entirely driven by personal battles and sort of interpersonal strife, who really enjoys poking at the people around him, keeping them unsettled and uncomfortable, and creating these little cage matches between his universe, which is certainly a style of management, but not one that I think any of our great leaders or military commanders would point to as an effective one. The what is the government doing is a really interesting question. I do believe, and you saw this in the hearing that you referenced from
right.
a few weeks ago
mm-hmm.
about the intelligence leaders briefing Congress on global threats, where every one of those agencies has certainly a plan for countering Russia, for exposing Russian intelligence, for tracking what they are doing in cyberspace and in physical space. But they all said there's no coordination between them because that has to come from the White House, and the interagency process on this does not exist because the White House does not believe Russia is really a threat. And that is tremendous to understand. And the fourth column, which is, do they have the capacity to keep doing this, is one that is worth paying attention to, especially because of the erosion of capabilities and capacity at the State Department, the continued attempts of the White House to remove funding from that agency. And I think it's why you see so many former intelligence operatives, even heads of all these agencies, who are normally extremely quiet except for big picture stuff, out in public, on
right.
TV, on radio, writing pieces, constantly saying, we need to pay attention to this. The Russians are still attacking us. They are going to continue to attack us until we stop them. And we absolutely need to pay attention to this and act. Because I think they now feel, many of them feel, everything they have been working on in their careers is basically being ignored by the current president. And that is probably not a great feeling when you also, many of them also believe that we just suffered the most significant attack on the American public that has probably ever happened.
Molly, I really appreciate the insight and the clarity. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.